Radio on.
Radio on.
Radio on. Radio on.
Radio on.
Radio, radio on. On.
Hello and welcome to Dial It for Thursday the 8th of December. Dial It is brought to you by the Bristol Broadband Cooperative via the Trinity Radio Project. I'm Chloe.
And I'm Gemma. And tonight we have interviews from Tony Gosling about Bristol's newspapers being sold and the implications that it will have on Bristolian journalism. He also has brought us an extensive report on strategy of tension, featuring an in-depth interview with MI5 whistleblower David Shaler and economist Martin Summers.
Other features in store for tonight include the What's On Guide with specially selected tracks from Jeff Dart, and later in the show the lyrically gifted Stanley Forbes will be with us with a song about David Cameron and another about Iraq. That's all coming up after the weather from Richard Ayres.
Yes, here is the weather forecast for Bristol for the next 2 weeks. Well, it is as warm as you can get in December. However, after a couple of weeks of more seasonal weather, as winds shift to the southwest later this week, so the temperatures will begin to climb. Before that, we've got some rain to deal with. This comes in during Wednesday in the form of a trough, which later develops into a small area of low pressure across the south of the country. Beginning tonight, overnight quite chilly, the strong winds we have experiencing, have been experiencing, will start to ease. Friday will have a pleasant outlook, especially towards midday, with temperatures creeping up to a whopping 6 or 7 degrees. Saturday again will be dry, with clouds, but the clouds will start to lift by late afternoon. Sunday, wow, a really great day of sunshine expected, not a cloud in the sky. Temperatures up to a maximum of 10.
Wow.
Monday and Tuesday will remain dry with some sunny spells, and on Wednesday is when things will start to change. Light rain is expected in the evening and some thick clouds. Thursday will be very cloudy, and there will be chances of showers throughout the day. That's a roundup of the weather for the next 2 weeks, brought to you by RadioDialect.net. And I believe now we have a tune called Technology by Electric at Large. Or is that electrical?
Electrical.
Excessive use.
That was Technology by Electrical. Next, we have Tony Gosling's recent interview with MI5 whistleblower David Shaler and economist Martin Summers for a Strategy of Tension special. This report looks into the history of terrorist bombings over the last 40 years and explores the similarities between the recent London bombings and previous attacks.
The strategy of tension was uncovered by parliamentary investigations in Italy. Which showed that the Italian secret services, working at the behest of the Americans and the British, and with the Mafia, had carried out various terrorist attacks in Italy during the 70s as part of a strategy to prevent the Italian Communist Party from being the elected government of Italy. This is all uncovered in Daniel Ganser's excellent book, NATO's Secret Armies, which came out last year, I believe.
But this must have been known about well before Daniel Ganser's book. And what sort of shape did these kind of attacks take, and what was the kind of purpose behind them?
Well, one of them was the assassination of the former Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro. And this, of course, was blamed on the Italian Red Brigades as an attempt to try and clap support for the left generally in Italy. But as parliamentary inquiries established that it was carried out through this kind of NATO intelligence service. Now, what they would do is take people in existing intelligence services like the Italian Military Intelligence Service. And have a few people who would be aware of Gladio, but only possibly one or two. But then they would work to other people, work with other people to bring about this kind of strategy of tension, basically.
The term Gladio means sword. What was the Gladio project?
It was a stay-behind project initially in the 1940s. The Western Intelligence Service, basically the British and the Americans, decided that if the Soviet Union overran Western Europe, they would require stay-behind teams like the SOE had been in World War II behind enemy lines. So that was the justification for the setting up of Gladio, was a supposedly secret network which would be totally inactive unless the Soviet Union rolled over the border and took over Western Europe. But in fact, these networks then began to be active within Western European politics, carrying out terrorist attacks and fomenting terrorism within Italy in particular, as a means of steering Western European politics in a Washington-friendly direction.
So as a network, was it simply sort of ex-military? And to what extent did they actually have their own weapons?
Well, it appears to be actually intelligence officers, as I say, in the existing services of Europe, but only very few people were briefed about this. And it appears that certain ministers, particularly in Italy, were briefed about it at the time. But they were kind of, you know, sworn to secrecy about it, and nobody was brave enough to ever mention this. But of course, when it came out in Italy, it caused a scandal, the idea that there would be intelligence services beyond the control of democracy. They were saying this is unconstitutional and so on. But of course, when the story arose in 1990, in Britain, we were saying, well, yes, it's, you know, people were looking at this being some kind of disgrace. But of course, at the time, MI6 and GCHQ were not on a legal footing in this country. So we were actually in that position anyway. Our parliamentary representative didn't know what went on in the intelligence services. But what's important to remember, of course, is how well equipped these secret armies were. That they were, you know, they had plenty of weaponry and plenty of C4 explosive. And to bring us up to 7-7, some of the earlier reports said that military explosive was used on those tube trains. And if that's the case, we've got to ask where that military explosive came from. And it appears to me what we're seeing now in terms of strategy of tensions, what they used against the left, they now appear to be using against the Muslim world, carrying out these false flag operations, again, to create the strategy of tension, to inflame public opinion against the Muslims and to obviously make it easier to invade foreign countries.
Now, this idea of false flag operations is quite an important one. Could one of you just explain what that means? I mean, it's the idea, I think, of trying to identify somebody else as the perpetrator when actually it's you that's caused a terrorist attack.
Yeah, exactly. You carry out a terrorist attack, but you make it look like another organisation, hence false flag. It was a term also used for militant tendency entryism in the 1980s when they would stand, for example, as a Labour Party candidate but would really be loyal to militants. So really it's just any activity you do where you pretend you're somebody else. And it's something that's actually used with great effect, I believe, by MI6 against MI5, strangely enough. From my experience of being in the service, there are occasions when I read about stuff in the press, and I would know from being in the service that MI5 wasn't doing this. And therefore, you've got to ask the question, who was? And MI6, we know, operates in Britain, so I believe it was them.
Yeah, but, you know, that sort of thing is real speculation. We have a lot of evidence about what happened in Italy. Can Martin, can you talk about how that affected Italian politics?
Well, I mean,
was it effective?
It was effective, because if you look at the Italian Communist Party, were on the verge of coming to power democratically from the 1940s well into the 1970s in Italy. They were the biggest single party. They had an honest reputation, an uncorrupt reputation, and there was every possibility that at some point they would form part of an Italian government. This wasn't acceptable in Washington. They would not allow it to happen. And they were prepared to intervene in Italian politics very, very strongly to prevent it happening. And they did this from the 1940s onwards. And one of the ways they did this was by cooperating with the mafia. As the Allies liberated Italy, they knew that the communists were likely to win free elections in many of the places that they were liberating. So the American authorities put local mafia chieftains in power, particularly in Sicily, because they'd already done a deal with Lucky Luciano, who was in prison in New York at the beginning of the invasion. And one of the things that the Allies did was let him out of prison on the understanding that he would speak to his comrades in the mafia in Italy and help the invasion. And that's how the mafia came to have a central role in post-war Italian politics, as a key kind of blocker for the communists. And they were working very closely with the CIA, as it then became, you know.
So of course, at the end of the Second World War, most of the, particularly in northern Italy, most of the cities were actually liberated by communist-leaning partisans, weren't they?
Exactly, which made the Communist Party very likely to win elections in Italy, and a very strong force in Italian politics, because they were the main opposition to Mussolini, and therefore stood to gain politically. And they did, but they never were allowed David mentioned Aldo Moro earlier. When he was kidnapped, supposedly by the Red Brigades, but now it appears by the state itself, he was setting off from his house at that moment to go and invite the Communist Party into the government of Italy. Aldo Moro was a moderate right-wing politician, and he saw the sense in bringing the communists into the system and allowing them to have some government ministries and so on. And that deal was called the Historic Compromise, and he was off to do that deal. But he never got there, and that deal was never done. And to this day, it's been very hard for the left. Has occasionally taken power in Italy, but have always been... Silvio Berlusconi is the latest front of the people who really run Italy and have run Italy since the 1940s.
And what about some of the more publicly devastating, rather than one individual being kidnapped, things like the Bologna railway station?
Well, that was the biggest and worst atrocity of this period, where 80-some-odd people were blown to bits in Bologna railway station. As part of a strategy of tension.
It always struck me as strange at the time that left-wing guerrillas would choose to explode a bomb in a second or third class, one of the sort of ordinary little waiting rooms where everyone, their aunties and uncles would be waiting around to catch a train. Doesn't seem like the natural place for a left-wing guerrillas.
Well, I mean, it was only very early on that they claimed that it was a left-wing bomb. Pretty soon, the official story turned to being that it was a right-wing bomb, a fascist bomb, because Bologna was a communist voting town. So all of these people blown up were probably communist voters. So it was blamed on the fascists. And a guy called Roberto Fiore eventually took refuge in Britain as a wanted fugitive in relation to the Bologna bombing and was protected by the British. But of course,
he is, isn't he?
I believe he still is. I don't know what's happened to him. But the point is that the fascists did not do it on their own. They did it with the help of the intelligence services. So don't forget, the strategy of tension didn't just involve manipulation of left-wing terrorism. It was left-wing terrorism and right-wing terrorism, just anything that makes trouble, problems, causes the population to feel fearful and to accept, special measures to ensure order. That's the basis of a strategy of tension.
Now, it did appear in the Gladio network in many countries, pretty much all countries, Scandinavia, right down to Greece, etc. What about Northern Ireland? Because that's somewhere which is a little bit closer to home.
Well, I don't think there was a strategy of tension of the same kind. It was a different one. There are lots of unexplained bombings and shootings that went on during that conflict.
But there is evidence of collaboration between the security forces and the loyalist terrorists, for example, in bombs planted in Dublin.
And Monaghan. There are two important reports that people need to be aware of. One is the Stevens report, which is Sir John Stevens' investigation into collusion between the British army and the loyalist paramilitaries, and also the Barron report. Judge Henry Barron is an Irish Supreme Court judge, and that's sitting in Bertie Ahern's in-tray, and that points the finger at British intelligence for the bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1974. The Stevens report deals with collusion subsequent to that. But these are two reports, one carried out by a Supreme Court judge, one carried out by the former head of the Metropolitan Police, and they are the factual evidence for the linkages between British intelligence and loyalist paramilitarism.
Stephen's report is really very recent. Are there any sort of outstanding unanswered questions or people that Stephen's report was unable to get?
Well, the main principal named in the report was Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who was at the time a Colonel Gordon Kerr, who was the head of the Force Research.
Does that mean he's been promoted since?
He's been promoted, and he is now, I understand, according to Neil Mackay, who's a Glasgow Herald journalist, he is now head of British military intelligence in Iraq. The reason being that he's got to be got off British turf, because in theory what Stevens was saying was that he had to be prosecuted, and I understood that Stevens had an agreement with Jackson, who's the head of the army, that he would be prosecuted, but that seems to have been forgotten. The whole thing has now been brushed under the carpet, probably as to do with the peace process and the deal that's being done with the Republicans. We'll forget about this if you forget about that.
Now, for many people, Dave, it's very difficult for them to imagine that the secret services and people like that really are so well organised, so well organised in blowing up people, or at least being involved with, from their own country. It just seems completely impossible and ridiculous for many people. Could you say whether you think it really is possible as someone who's worked in the service?
Yeah, I mean, I am a witness to how MI6 funded Al-Qaeda in 1996. This is when we knew they were a threat to British lives. What actually happened was they paid tens of thousands of pounds to an associate of bin Laden in Libya to try and assassinate Gaddafi. This operation failed, innocent people were killed. But the operation was carried out without the permission of government, so basically nobody in the Conservative administration at the time knew anything about this attack. And of course, I think now, in the light of what's happened in Afghanistan and Iraq, this was the first attempt to really to invade a country, to put Al-Qaeda in charge, and then turn around the international community and say, look, these religious extremists are in charge, this is dangerous for the region. So they then get their resolution from the UN, go in, take the country as they inevitably would, but then, of course, they'd have to control the Libyan oil supply, and they'd be able to build bases in Libya as they are now doing in Iraq.
Someone who's worked within the intelligence services, you have to work in these things to know how they need to be changed and altered. Have you ever sort of put forward any kind of ideas or proposals of how there could be more effective accountability and democratic oversight?
Yeah, I mean, with the intelligence services in Britain, we really need to abolish MI5 and MI6. They're a hangover from empire. They spend their time competing with each other, bickering behind the scenes. They're not cooperative. And therefore, if you replace that with one dedicated counter-terrorist organisation, you would have somebody who worked more, an organisation that worked more effectively. But in terms of oversight, we just need to do some simple things. We need to pass whistleblower legislation so that if intelligence officers see things going wrong, they can go to Parliament and get a hearing in front of a committee, and the intelligence services have to cooperate that. They have to give up documents and answer questions under oath. So it's not difficult to bring these services under control. And I mean, it is important that we do have a security service in a democracy, because there are people in this country who want to put bombs down and so on. I don't think we should ever forget that. And that is legitimate. But what is the problem with the services? Because they're allowed to work in secret, they're not loyal to the interests of this country, and certainly not loyal to the interests of democracy. And that's a scandal, because we pay their bloody wages, basically.
Now, anyone working in the service or working closely with the MI6 and MI5 would say, well, actually, there's two completely different roles. That one is gathering intelligence from abroad, and the other one is trying to stop foreign powers gathering intelligence in Britain primarily.
That's not really quite correct. I mean, MI5 carry out intelligence investigations at home. MI6 do similar kind of intelligence work abroad. I mean, obviously, there are differences in the roles. But what we need is an organisation out there that can, one, recruit good agents, reliable agents that they can task and so on. And two, we need an organisation that can actually analyse the information as it comes in. What people don't realise at the moment is MI6 don't actually assess their own intelligence. MI5 assess all security intelligence, including information coming from MI6. But of course, MI5 can play that information down or bump it up according to its own agenda. And I think that's something that we saw with the September dossier. We saw how intelligence could be just manipulated in that particular way. So the only way we eradicate that is by separate the intelligence gathering function from the intelligence analysis function. And then there's no conflict of interest. They won't be tempted to do that. And of course, the skills you need to work in those two services are very different. You need to go and gather intelligence, you need to be very good, you know, in terms of being out there, being able to win the confidence of agents. Whereas if you're an analyst, you need to be better on paper at picking, you know, reading through documents and picking out that nugget and the other nugget and, you know, putting two of them together and making four. So one of the reasons that the services are so ineffective is that MI5 has too many people who are good on paper going out there and working in the field and really kind of ballsing up the whole operation.
Getting back to the bombs in London on the 7th of July, it does seem that some of the key figures who've been implicated in that have slipped through the net.
Well, if you're probably referring to Haroon Aswat, who was named in the early stages of the investigation as the mastermind. But he's been named by John Loftus on TV in America, John Loftus being former US Attorney General, as an MI6 double agent. So the suggestion is that MI6 recruited the bombers through their agent and possibly put them up to the deed. Now, that may sound incredible to people, but if you think about what we've just been saying, all the other things we've been saying in this interview, it's not an incredible thing to suggest. We can't be sure because we're all in the dark here, but it's got to be a question. What I would say to anybody listening to this is any terrorist attack anywhere, whether it's in Jordan or London or Madrid or New York on September the 11th, there's always got to be a question about who perpetrated. And you shouldn't just presume that because somebody claims it or somebody else blames it on somebody, that is the truth. It's not necessarily the case, and frankly, usually it isn't the case.
Surely, the guy who's the mastermind of the London bomb would be immediately arrested and put on trial. You know, or maybe if he was in a foreign country, extradited to Britain, and it would be quite a high-profile case, I would have thought.
Oh, sorry about that. Slight technical hitch, I think. Anyway, now we've got a track from Mulch, and we'll try and bring you the rest of that interview at a later time.
Unfortunately, unfortunately, we can't bring you any more of the David Shaler and Martin Summers report that we were listening to earlier, but we can assure you that you will find the full report online just after the weekend on the Dialect website. That's radiodialect.net. Okay, now we've got in the studio with us a young filmmaking talent, and he's here to talk about a little bit about the filmmaking community and his work at The Cube. Is that right?
Not exactly, but certainly things to do with short films, short film related rubbish, and some stuff that we're doing with my own organisation called Lovewood Films. We're a little organisation made up of filmmakers, musicians, actors, various technical people, and we're together in a kind of filmmaking community, very kind of amorphous and, is that a word? I don't know. Organic, but quite a few of us. And we come together to make various films, kind of community-based films, a couple of ones for businesses, videos, and little kind of short features as well.
So what kind of work have you been doing so far?
Well, we've been doing some stuff for the 92nd Challenge, which has been run by the Watershed early this year. Entered some stuff in that, a few little films. We've done a few features, which we also get shown at the Cube Cinema, which is, I believe, the only microplex in the Stokes Croft area. Very nice little place. Get down there if you can. Every month they show, well, they have a night called, I think it's Blue Screen, where they show kind of local films by local filmmakers. Show some stuff down there. Doing some stuff for businesses at the moment as well, as part of a kind of business arts initiative, again through the Watershed. And yeah, we're open to any kind of suggestions or any help from people. Anybody wants to join our small band of merry pranksters is quite welcome. Actors, filmmakers, musicians, anything like that, any kind of technical knowledge anybody has.
And what kind of interest would somebody who wants to get involved need to have?
Filmmaking interest. Basically, sorry, sarcastic. Well, any kind of, you know, we're open to any kind of ideas at all. People can bring their own ideas, or, you know, they can help us with ideas that we've got ourselves.
What kind of ideas are you working on at the moment?
Well, we're working on, at the moment, we've got two projects underway. We're working on a feature, which is a kind of, how should I describe it, a love story through time travel and mixing death and all kinds of nonsense in there. We're doing that for our own pleasure at the moment, but we're also involved in a film for a business, which is a firm of interior designers. So we've got a few irons in the fire at the moment, and it's all looking pretty exciting.
Sounds good. So is this all Bristol-based?
This is all Bristol-based, indeed. Bristol artists, Bristol people, Bristol businesses, Bristol locations.
And how would people get in contact with you if they wanted to hear more about it or actually get involved?
Well, if anybody's interested at all in either taking part or just wants a bit more information about the kind of things we do, they can contact me, Peter Webster, on our email address, which is at hotmail.co.blah.
Excellent. Thanks very much for coming in, Peter, and talking to us a little bit about Lovewood Films.
Dorothy Dear, General Secretary, and you.
Oh, sorry. And now we're off to our second feature. More technical hitches there. We've got Dialect's Tony Gosling again, but he was busier earlier this week speaking with the General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists, Jeremy Dear. Jeremy, who has been speaking out against the selling off of Bristol's local newspapers, has been commenting on how this will affect the consumers that buy them.
Jeremy Dear, General Secretary NUJ, and I'm down here, first of all, to support our members on their rally, which is part of their campaign against job losses and in defence of quality local news at the Bristol papers, but also because this is part of a much wider battle amongst journalists and amongst local communities to protect their local newspapers, to protect local news from those who really just see it as a means to make a lot of profit and don't really care that much about the communities they serve.
Now, you've been involved in in Northcliffe disputes yourself, how can that inform what's going on here today and in Bristol and the other cities in the Northcliffe regional newspaper empire?
Well, I think if you look at what Northcliffe have done over a number of years, it has been to steadily increase the rate of profit that they make from their local newspapers. And there's only two ways to do that. One is to sell more newspapers, and the other is to cut the costs. And if you're cutting costs, it generally means cutting jobs. Since they say they can't sell any more newspapers and that the newspaper market is in decline, then they've resorted to cutting jobs. Our problem with that is that it's a completely false economy, that what they're, every time you cut a journalist's job, you lose more readers, and you end up in a vicious downward spiral of lost sales and job cuts. And we think that what they need to do is invest in quality local journalism, invest in editorial in order to win more readers. That wins more advertisers and you can build growth.
Now, the management would say there's not really any competition in Bristol for them, so just in order to cut costs, it makes sense for them to cut down the editorial staff.
Well, it makes sense if your only remit is to make more profit for your shareholders, they see their remit as. We think that they should have a remit to provide quality local news and information for the communities they seek to serve, and to do that, they should invest in the titles instead of cutting jobs.
Now, we heard last week that they're planning to quite possibly sell the newspaper group. What point can there be in that? If they're just trying to get higher profits, why should they then want suddenly to sell it off?
Well, what this current programme of cost-cutting they've got called Aim Higher really now appears to be about is about cutting the costs to the bone so they can sell it for the highest price possible. And they're now looking at getting, I can't remember, £1.5 billion for the newspaper group after making £30 million cuts. On the one hand, they say they have to make the cuts because the papers aren't profitable. On the other hand, they say, oh, they're highly profitable and pay us as much money as you can to buy them. Now, they can't have it both ways, and it appears that the cost-cutting exercise is merely just a kind of cynical ploy to push the price up.
How is this, if it is sold off, who's it likely to be sold to and how will it affect local people?
Well, there appear to be three possible types of buyers. Either one of the existing regional newspaper groups who already have pretty significant monopolies, and to be honest, in most aspects aren't that much different from kind of Northcliffe type control of the papers. Or there seem to be some of the big continental groups, newspaper groups, who are interested in getting into the UK newspaper market. Or there's the kind of private equity companies that have bought up a number of newspapers who seek to get as much short-term profit out of them and then sell them on to something else, to another company. What we'd really like to see is the government look at the whole nature of media ownership and look at more local control, more local ownership of newspapers, and consider breaking up some of these big groups so that local communities have much more of an interest in their local newspapers, and they aren't owned from some corporate headquarters in the US or very remote from the communities they seek to serve. And I think that's a debate that we need to have with politicians, with local communities, with media companies about the future ownership pattern we'd like to see in local newspapers.
And many local people will just think, well, it doesn't really matter who owns the newspaper so long as it's there for me every day and it's cheap to buy it.
The danger is that if you simply have a company whose sole aim is to make profit and they keep cutting journalist jobs, that you end up with less investigative journalism, less high quality journalism, you end up with more people just sitting in an office rewriting press releases. And actually, in the end, the local community suffers because they don't know what's going on in the local hospital, in the local school, or amongst local councillors and so on. And it's vitally important that local communities have a source of news and information they can trust and that is reliable and that's well-resourced in order to enable them to make decisions about local democratic issues.
And finally, what chance do you think there is that the journalists' jobs will be saved in the new year and they win this dispute?
Well, we certainly hope that they will, and we will do everything we can to try and make sure that happens. One of the things that we would say to Northcliffe is that they should stop this cost-cutting exercise now, allow any new owners of the paper to engage in a proper discussion with the journalists, with the editorial staff, with ourselves, with the local community about what type of paper they really want to serve them here in this local community. And I think that would be an important step. If it isn't just about making as much money as possible, then the challenge to them is stop the cuts now and let's talk to new owners.
That was the General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists, Jeremy Deer, speaking with Dialect reporter Tony Gosling there. Next, we have a track by a band called The Photos, and the track is called Hanging by a Thread. I hope you enjoy it.
You know Why don't you need me no more?
Radio Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check our website on radiodialect.net.
Okay, next up we have Jeff with What's On this week out and about in Bristol.
Thank you, Chloe. Good evening. This is your weekly What's On guide from Radio Dialect. Starting with tomorrow night, we have the Yo-Yos featuring Danny from What the Wild Hearts and also Anti-Product at the Bristol Beer Keller. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance and £10 on the door. Also tomorrow night, this time at the Anson Rooms, there is Viking Skull performing. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance and £7 on the door. And finally, for tomorrow night, this time at the Guildhall in Gloucester, those punk veterans of Voice Squad will be performing. I'm not sure what the entry fee is, but the doors open at 7 p.m. Moving on to Saturday night at the Full Moon in Stokes Croft, the Osmium side project Sex Gods from the Planet Metal will be performing with support from Ye Gods. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is at £4 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and we have a brand new track from the band Rat Daddy, who have been away for the past 10 months and have returned with a new lineup and new songs. This is the track Peter Says.
Survive. Peter says, "Man, thirst is a
That was Rat Daddy with Peter Says. And for more information on the band, check out www.ratdaddy.co.uk. Keeping with Saturday night, and this time at the Old Duke in Bristol, Dynamo's Rhythm Aces will be performing. This band perform a diverse selection of mostly latter-day hits in a boogie-woogie stroke 1940s swing style. And this gig is free entry, and the band should be on stage around 9 p.m. And finally, for Saturday night at the Prom Bar in Bristol, the popular Blues Brothers tribute group Kick the Cat will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Finally, we have for Sunday night at the Beer Keller, the Brides of Destruction, who have been touring the UK, and I believe this date is the last one of the tour. This American rock band feature Tracy Guns of LA Guns fame. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £13.50 in advance. That's all from me tonight. Hope you have a great weekend, and looking at the choice of gigs, it will be a great weekend. Thank you and good night.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Some cool sounding stuff in there. Next up, we've got a track by a band called Aquila, and the track is called Sellout.
We'll be right back. Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check our website on radiodialect.net.
Radiodialect.net.
Okay, now we have a very special guest for you. It's Stanley Forbes, here with some exclusive tracks. Take it away, Stanley.
Hello, good evening. Lovely to be on Radio Dialect once more. I've actually got two songs for you this week, and the main story of the week, of course, involved this man, David Cameron, and all this talk about, you know, consensual politics and reds becoming blues and becoming like a purpley kind of weird colour. But I didn't want to write a song about that. I wrote a different kind of song about something that I saw on Tuesday about David Cameron as well. Thanks. So here it is, hopefully. Right. I saw a wonderful picture in the Daily Mail on Tuesday that blew my mind and my underwear away. It tickled my fancy and it grabbed my goat. It alerted my semen as it rocked my boat. It was the most stimulating photo I've ever seen in my entire life. And it was of the new Tory leader kissing his wife, Davy C, you do it for me. What I once seldom did, I now do frequently. And not only often, but furiously. Consequently, my tank is running on low. So that was the David Cameron song. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Just a short little... Now I'll crack straight on with a proper song. Featuring a human trombone from Larry, who's the ghost who lives inside me. Those dastardly Iraqis, insubordinate, cheeky chappies. It's not as if we can't blow them all to hell and back. In this state of emergency, must we be faced with insurgency? All our boys are scared to attack out there in Iraq. Ready? Don't you want to be free? Thanks, Saddam. It's a great opportunity to rescue your economy and pander to the American dream. Even though the frequency of innocent casualties is higher
dance regime. Wake up and live the American dream. We got guns, we got choppers, we got planes. We're gonna scatter the dusty streets with the remains of your brains. And we'll shower your cities with droplets of mortar. We'll arrest you unfairly and subject you to torture. Who cares if our soldiers take a liking to your daughter? Cause we're gonna send you all to slaughter, just like God's told George that we ought to. Don't you want to be free?
Yes, I want to be free.
I love democracy. It's a great opportunity to rescue your economy. So put some oil in the money machine. Yes, the frequency of innocent casualties is higher than Saddam's regime. Oh, wake up and live the American dream.
Thank you very much. StanleyForbes@gmail.com. If you fancy dropping me a line and telling me how crap I am, then I shall send you some poisoned custard in the post, and you will die.
Lovely. Thank you, Stanley.
No problem. Thank you.
That was truly like nothing I've ever heard before.
It was
marvellous. I hope you all enjoyed it. I'm afraid that's pretty much it for tonight. If you enjoyed the show, then do get in touch with us. Just send us an email to studio@radiodialect.net. Or if you're interested in volunteering, then you can get in touch with Through Volunteering Bristol, who you can find on Royal Oak Avenue, or you can give them a ring on 0117 989 7733. We're going to play you out with a track from a guy called Dave Green, but I can't remember its name. Oh, it's called Melancholic, and it's from an album called From In a Matchbox. Sorry. Good night, and have a good evening.
to believe. You tell me you're preparing to leave, and all of the world is on a reel. Yeah, what did it mean to tell me the world is surreal? Smile on a strange second.